Hollywood. That's gooey, bally, hooly Hollywood. Where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan.
And any shop girl can be a top girl if she pleases the tired businessman.
Hooray for Hollywood! You may be homely in your neighborhood.
From the outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota, it is a very special episode of That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else, films. I'm your co-host, Nick Cooey, joined by my co-host, as always, Alex Cooey, to talk about the Academy Awards and the very special circumstances that this year's Oscars will be facing. Alex, what are your thoughts about this very unusual year for the Academy Awards?
Hello, everybody. I just want to start off by saying that we will be taking over hosting duties from Bob Hope and Dean Martin this episode.
For some reason, they were unavailable. I mean,
yeah, I am not sure why. You know, it's complex stuff. But we're here, and and thank you for tuning in. To answer your question about the Oscars, like my thoughts, I mean, well, just to put in a nutshell, it's a very interesting kind of year.
Well, unquestionably. I feel like that's almost like a cop-out answer. Like, call something interesting is, you know, it's like what we say here. It's Minnesota interesting. That's a loaded term for...
Yeah, just being Minnesota polite. Yeah, but, I mean,
but,
like...
But I don't know, man. I mean, I think that... I mean, I think what's interesting, of course, because of the challenges that the film industry has been facing the last year because of the COVID-19 pandemic, I think that it's caused people within the industry to be confronted with this sort of, with all of the attendant sociopolitical strife that's arisen in conjunction with the COVID-19 pandemic. And in here, particularly in the United States, I mean, throughout the world, of course, but I think a lot of we've been seeing, you know, a lot of the kind of the protest movements, particularly related to Black Lives Matter, a lot of the civil unrest caused in large part by the 45th president of the United States. And I mean, with that in mind, you have kind of this, I mean, it's always interesting to like look at a roster of Oscar movies, right? Because like half the time they sort of tap into the zeitgeist and are reflections of the time they came out, and other times they are indicative of a trend that will seem really archaic, you know, in 5 years, let alone 10 years or 50 years.
And, you know, and sometimes there are some movies that I feel can be a little bit of both, actually, that have been nominated at the Oscars over the years, where they are something, movies that are maybe trying to tap into the zeitgeist, but they're kind of like you get the feeling or inkling they're made just to receive accolades primarily. I mean, hence why they're labeled as Oscar bait.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And so with all that in mind, I mean, it is, I mean, I think, you know, we were kind of both talking a little bit about what we were going to talk about with this podcast. You know, I mean, of course, we'd be talking about the winners or who we think will win versus who we think should win. But we wanted to kind of open it by sort of reflecting on the state of the Oscars themselves and like, and kind of what sort of, you know, what perception you can glean from the films that are available now. And Alex, what, I mean, just judging from like the films that you have seen, which are nominated, what's kind of your impression in terms of like what sort of, I mean, cultural narrative that this roster of films is sort of perpetuating?
Well, that's a good question. The cultural narrative. I mean, like, because, yeah, I have seen all the Best Picture nominees, and I have seen a good share of the films nominated this year. And the impression I get of the cultural narrative is that I think it is, a lot of the work is kind of tapping into, I think, the deep divisions that are currently occurring in this country. And, you know, and they talk about lots of issues such as social issues, racial issues, class issues. And it's interesting to see like how maybe some of these films, they discuss some of like especially the age of, you know, the effects of living in Trump's America and of some of the movements you listed, including like the Black Lives Matter movement, and where they give them a contemporary context to like, you know, just when thinking about social stuff, you see films like Nomadland, for instance, mm-hmm. or or through more, or maybe they reflect this through period pieces like Minari or Judas and the Black Messiah or right. Trial of the Chicago Seven.
Right, right, exactly. It seems that like there has been sort of this concerted effort to kind of nominate films which are explicitly, in one way or another, speaking to America's sort of cultural history. I mean, either in the present tense or in the past, particularly within kind of the late 60s, early 70s, to sort of gauge a sense of where we are in this precipitous, perilous moment for the world, you know, really, but I mean, particularly for the United States. And of course, that doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, we there are certainly some international features that have had some breakout success at the Oscars this year. I mean, most notably Thomas Vinterberg's film, Another Round, Doc, but I don't think it has quite the same sort of traction as something like Parasite did last year, which became a big phenomenon.
Yeah, and I don't, and even Minari, which, you know, I think some people might have expected it to become sort of the next Parasite because, you know, it also has like a Korean family in it too. And it had a lot of buzz to it ever since its debut at Sundance. But I don't think it's also, you know, been quite the pop cultural phenomenon that Parasite was. I mean, Parasite was kind of almost like lightning in a bottle, you know.
This is a completely asinine question, but is it pronounced Minari or Minari? Because I remember watching some of PBS the other day, and they were pronouncing it Minari. And...
Well, it could be. I forget how they pronounce it in the film, so I apologize to any listeners if I completely...
For any of our any listeners who are fluent in Korean, if you have any suggestions on the correct pronunciation, please let us know in the comments. Actually, we will be talking about Minari, or Minari, whatever the case may be, in detail in some time. But for now, I think I just wanted to kind of also think a little bit about, you know, I mean, just this weird sort of dynamic about the fact that the Oscars are trying to be engaging with a lot of the unrest that's currently pervading everyday life here in America. And yet at the same time, there's something curiously bizarre about having an award show in the middle of a pandemic.
Well, you know, I mean, it's always felt kind of like, I think the Oscars have always kind of struggled in like connecting with most American audiences. I mean, like we've seen, I mean, of course, you can look at the Nielsen ratings of like audience viewership dipping, you know, by, you know, quite a pace over the years. But now, especially with this pandemic, you know, I think there's even more of like that question, you know, in crisis of like, what is the Oscars place going to be? And that's why I find it interesting how they've been trying to, you know, when I was looking up some details of, you know, of the news about like how they were going to do the show, they even had a producer's press conference the other day, and even having Steven Soderbergh attached to the ceremony, mm-hmm. which I find very intriguing. And it's like they want to try and find ways to, like, I think connect with an audience and make it feel engaging. Whether it's like, you know, they're trying to do some safety policies regarding like quarantining with hubs, or even like just to the filmmaking aspect. Like even Soderbergh was describing the ceremony as like a narrative, mm-hmm. you know, which I found very interesting the way he was describing it. And even when they were asking a question about like about masks, wearing them, he said, yeah, masks are going to be a very key part of the story.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting. That's an interesting component to think about. And I mean, I'm just always in amazement at how much time Steven Soderbergh has on his hands.
Yeah. He's apparently making yet another movie while this pandemic's going on. I mean, that guy, yeah, I admire his tenacity.
Well, I mean, he also did a director's cut of Kafka last year while in quarantine, and yeah. like another edit of one of his other movies, I think. Oh, and then he had the one film that was on HBO Max with Meryl Streep. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's good to know that you know, he's always got things to do. But I'm very curious to see how like he, you know, because as a filmmaker who's also worked within different mediums and embraced kind of a lot of these different mediums in a way, like it'll be interesting to see how that reflects in the show itself. Of course, we're recording this before the show has even aired, so we can only speculate. But I will say the one thing that, again, I think the trouble is, you know, convincing a national populace to watch an award show when so many people are suffering, that's a tall order.
I mean, it's like, you know, I think about how like there was the joke Billy Crystal made when he hosted last time, and it was during like the economic crisis. And he said, there's no better way to help Americans get through economic hardships than watch rich people give each other golden statuettes. And it's like, Well, how do you think they'll feel during a pandemic?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. Well, we're already. Yeah, exactly. We've got a economic crisis now because of this pandemic. It's just, but you slap the two together and yeah,
it's makes a very toxic sandwich.
And it's frankly, to me, I think it's also more than a little problematic that the Academy has asked its members to sort of apply for status as essential workers to attend the awards show. I mean, I believe that was in the Hollywood Reporter that story was breaking out.
Yeah, and it's been circulating around in other news articles too. Have been shared like by AV Club, in which I love the AV Club's headline, which they said, "Oh, great, Oscar nominees are quote essential workers now," and yeah, that's really bothered me too. Reading that, not because you know I'm against like say crew members you know getting vaccinated or anything like that, you know, and not saying that making a movie is easy, you know, far from it. It can be an incredibly demanding job for everyone involved in the industry. But, you know, when there's like when the demand for vaccinations still are far greater than vaccine supplies, you know, you just think about like who, you know, maybe needs it more, you know. And I just think about like more like doctors and teachers, you know, people who maybe have more that they're supposed to go out, you know, to work every day. Whereas, you know, for like film shoots, sometimes you do like 3-6 months out of a year, you know, given.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's here's the thing. I mean, we're not saying that any profession is. I mean, as people who have worked within the industry now, you know, I know a lot of people who are working in the industry, and I mean, this is a really, really, it's a difficult time for a lot of filmmakers, exhibitors, programmers, to be working now in these conditions, and of course, it's not easy. I think it just kind of ties into sort of the one component of the Oscars, which is a key facet of its character, and it's the component that really bugs me, and it's always bugged me, is that the show has often been a form of self-congratulatory applause for itself, for the industry, for people within the industry. And I think that sort of egoism, you know, in years past, it's just been somewhat banal. But I do think in the middle of a pandemic, there's a particular degree of obliviousness with trying to get celebrities vaccinated just so they can sit around in gowns. And, you know, people think that, you know, again, like your average person who has not been going to the movies this year, but maybe will be watching movies at home if they have an internet connection. Otherwise, if they don't, I mean, they won't know what's happening culturally. It's just, it speaks to a certain level of obliviousness that it needs to, I don't know. I think it just ties back into that whole sense of, you know, self-aggrandizement that I think is the least attractive quality of the Oscars, because it's not really even about the quality of films. And I mean, and it's particularly a shame this year when I think we had to really find a lot of films that had been circling out there, there were films that we were expecting to be big Oscar players that ended up getting delayed. And as a result, then there was the hope of thinking, well, maybe films that would have had a harder time in years past, maybe they'll actually be nominated this year. And I think you could argue that maybe for some films that was the case. But I do think that there were also quite a number of movies that were snubbed. But we'll be getting to that at the end of the program.
Yeah, I just want to say about that, you know, I completely agree with what you were saying about the whole, like, you know, this egotism and, like, self-congratulatory attitude, you know, patting itself on the back. And I feel like the Oscars, the way they exhibit this, it's like a symptom of just, I think, Hollywood more in general. And I think, you know, last summer we sort of, like, discussed about, like, Hollywood's kind of, like, identity crisis, you know, especially during the age of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And with theaters and film, and just the whole process of filmmaking. But I think it's like, you know, that whole attitude of like just to you know, just to create a show so that they can give each other a pat on the back, and almost like almost willingly trying to distract people. You know, I'm not saying that you should always, you know, make people feel down about what's going on, but to like say, act like there's no pandemic or no problem going on. That's what really.
There's a very fine line between escapism and absolutely gaudy indulgence and privilege. And I think that the Oscars is not always good about towing that line. It never has been. And I think this year this year, that's the biggest challenge that I think that is facing the Academy right now. Aside from, of course, picking, you know, good winners, but that's always been a challenge for them. And, you know, half the time they're right, but, you know, they can't please everybody.
I mean, yeah, I mean, like, they can't always choose Citizen Kane. Sometimes they just choose that one film that no one remembers the title to.
I mean, How Green Was My Valley? I'm pretty sure Kristen Thompson would beg to differ, my friend, but we'll get into a cinephile debate about this some other day when we actually review How Green Was My Valley. But
fair enough.
but I think for now, I think we should look a little bit about the actual films and think about, I mean, you know, we in the years past, we've, you know, kind of done articles on the website where we've talked about all of the categories. And this year we were thinking about an actual episode of this and we thought maybe we should kind of condense this to the five major categories. And that doesn't mean we won't bring up in conversation a couple of the other categories that are going to be talked about or discussed or focused on for the Oscars. But I think that maybe we'll start with kind of we'll just kind of work with the basic big category. So something like, I think starting from a place like Best Actor is as good as any to start. And I got to be honest, you know, I mean, I have to make a confession, Alex. I have not seen still, I've seen almost all of the nominees which for posterity's sake, there are Riz Ahmed for Sound of Metal, Steven Yeun for Minari or Minari, depending who you ask. You have Chadwick Boseman, of course, nominated for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
You have Gary Oldman.
Oldman, of course, for Mank. And then the last one, Anthony Hopkins for The Father. And I've seen all the films except for The Father. I have not had a chance to watch it, but you have. And you've seen all of the nominees in this category.
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. That's true.
So then what are your thoughts on the category?
Well, actually, I think this is a very good category this year. I have to confess, I think that all the nominees give excellent performances in this category. And it's actually quite hard to choose. It was difficult for me to think of which one to pick. I mean, I think the general consensus is that people believe they're going to give it to Boseman, you know. And I think it's a way to honor him and his legacy and his career. And, you know, it's nice to do that. And, you know, and even if he had lived, you know, I still think that he's still very good in the movie. Mm. You know, honestly, like, if I had to pick my winner, it actually is, I think I'd have to go with Steven Yeun for Minari. Mm-hmm. And I decided to go with this movie primarily because of the performance itself, and because I think of the trajectory Steven Yeun's career has taken to this point. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like this film has culminated into what has been a very versatile and impressive and illustrious career for Steven Yeun as an actor. I mean, considering how a lot of people first became aware of him for his role on The Walking Dead, I think in the last few years he's just been on a roll with the roles he's taken and showing just how his range as an actor, from Burning, you know, when she could be chilling and menacing, to something more silly and comedic like Tuca and Birdie.
Yeah, which, of course, you know, one of the highlights of this year is that we're getting season 2 of Tuca and Birdie.
Yeah, hope he appears on it. Fingers crossed.
I don't know. It's always just great on this podcast when we get a chance to kind of plug Tuca and Birdie because it's, you know, it's a wonderful show.
And also just plug in because we've also been watching the Amazon series Invincible, which he stars in. And he's great in that too. And I feel like with this, it also showcases how, I just feel like he shows he can do so many different kinds of roles. But with this particular role, I went for him also because I feel like he really gave a lot of humanity and grounded to realism to this character that made him believable, so that you can understand like the passions and goals he has for his life, where he clearly has lots of love for his wife and his children, his whole family, but he also is kind of frustrated because also has these ambitions and goals and dreams that he wants to achieve in America, but he's just struggling to get through them, you know, like trying to set up his own farm, but doesn't feel like he's quite achieving those yet. And they're kind of putting him on, you know, on an end, you know, strained ends with even his wife. But he, you know, and I think he hits the right note where you kind of wish to see, like, with his family still stay together, but you can also understand where he's coming from with his, you know, desires and his frustrations. And I think he makes the character very sympathetic and believable. And I think it's just, I think it's a wonderful performance.
I mean, I think it's a very, I mean, I think it's a very subtle performance in a lot of ways. And yet it feels very lived in. And I think that's kind of what you were getting at, is just that, that lived in quality that he brings to the character of this father, who has that, that streak of the, of a kind of a foolish dreamer in him. And I think Yun, who I'm also a big fan of, I mean, and you singled out Burning, which was one of my favorite films of the decade. It was my favorite film of that year that it came out. And I thought he was really exceptional in that film, and he really deserved an Oscar nomination for that. So, but I'm glad that, of course, he's getting some overdue recognition for this film, because it is a very different role, and it's one that requires a very carefully modulated degree of naturalism, because otherwise that character could very easily fall into some sort of archetypal mold of this sort of stubborn father who's just has no real idea about what he's doing to his family. And I think it's just a strong ensemble all around for the film. But I mean, I, you know, if I have to be honest, like I would probably, I mean, I haven't seen Anthony Hopkins, so I don't know if he's going to give Chadwick Boseman a run for his money, though I think that...
I mean, considering that he did win the BAFTA in a surprise upset.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that it bodes well for him. But I will say that I do think, from my end, you know, I'm not quite sure who will win, if it's going to be Boseman or Hopkins. But if I had to pick the winner, I must be honest, Alex, I, as much as I love Steven Yeun, and as much as I would agree with you, I think all the actors in this category do exceptional work, I am inclined to lean ever so slightly towards Riz Ahmed. He's another actor who, like Steven Yeun, he's been just exceptional in a lot of character actor roles for several years now. The first time I ever saw him in a movie was in Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal, and he left an impression on me then. And so he's been one of those faces I've always tried to kind of keep an eye out for. And I think it's been wonderful to see him have such a great year between this and Mogul Mowgli, which has had a British release. It's not been released in the States yet, but I think that there's something about The Sound of Metal, which I actually just watched last night, that's anchored in a lot of Ahmed's performance. I think he has to play this character in a way that communicates one of the core themes of the film, which is that it's a film about addiction where you don't actually see any drugs at all.
In the film, like, his character is a guy who has been 4 years clean.
Well, that's exactly the point. It's that he's a 4 years clean addict, and so he's a person with he's a person with an addictive personality, but he's not indulging in a lot of the stereotypes of what we would consider an on-screen addict, whatever that might look like. It's more about a person who is in need of control over his life, and he doesn't have that anymore once he goes deaf. And he has to adjust to that. And I think Ahmed really, in a very, again, like Steven Yeun, in a very naturalistic and unforced way, I think he conveys a lot of the multifaceted, unspoken feelings of resentment towards that his character holds towards himself, the sense of guilt that he has about some of his past mistakes, in terms of being an addict with his girlfriend, and also his own feelings and realization about how he is changing, and his life will change completely regardless of what he does, and he has to either resist against that for the rest of his life or accept it. And I think that there's seeing that transformation between of someone who starts as somebody who's constantly like in a sense of friction against life to having some semblance of acceptance. I think it's a really remarkable and often moving spectacle to watch unfold, and it's because of a skilled performer like Ahmed that we're able to buy this character as a living person. I think it's a really tremendous performance in a pretty strong film on the whole.
Yeah, no, The Sound of Metal is a very good film, and I do agree with you. Like, Ahmed, he truly does commit to the role through and through, and I have seen him in a few movies over the years, and I do feel like, you know, and I'm very glad to see that him also getting recognition, especially for a role like this, and especially after, you know, some of the stuff I've seen him in, he was good in, or they were good, like Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, or others which I felt he kind of was, like, wasted in, like when he was the antagonist in Venom with Tom Hardy.
Well, thankfully, he can hopefully put his Venom days far, far behind him.
Let us hope so.
Yeah, whether he wins or not, but we'll have to see. And I mean, I'm thinking now about, you know, because the Best Actor race is actually pretty competitive, you were saying, or like it's a really strong roster of names, but I feel like Best Actress is just as if not more competitive this year.
Yes, though I guess if we're going to make confessions here, I've only seen three of the Best Actress nominees. Mm. But yes, even those that I've seen, like all of them have been, yeah, they're quite stellar work. So, I mean, you're right. There have been, I will say, actually, there's a lot of great performances nominated this year.
Mm-hmm. Because, let's see, we have Vanessa Kirby in Pieces of a Woman, Frances McDormand in Nomadland, yes. Carey Mulligan in Promising Young Woman, Andra Day in...
The United States versus Billie Holiday.
Mm-hmm. And then...
We have Viola Davis in...
Viola Davis in Ma Rainey.
Bottom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a very... I mean, it's a great roster of performances and roles, because I think it's actually it's quite eclectic in terms of the characters that these performers are inhabiting, and I think it's one of those things where you kind of have to go with your gut, because in terms of who I think will win, I think relating to precursor awards, I think it could really go to quite a number of people. I think Violet Davis is a dark horse. I think Andra Day could pull an upset, but I think that the front runner right now seems to be Carey Mulligan, and truthfully, she's my pick too. I mean, about who I would pick, if only because I think that the film that she's in, Promising Young Woman, it is one of those films that's so contingent upon a single performance, in a different way than something like Sound of Metal is also contingent upon this lead performance. But, I mean, because the film is even so outre and so bold and brash aesthetically, you need a performance that can somehow match that energy and yet give it some sort of, can anchor it in some way, in some sort of verisimilitude. So the film doesn't just completely tether off into this series of, into a series of agitprop, that it actually taps into a very real human tragedy that fuels this rather curious rape revenge movie, if we can even call it a rape revenge movie.
Yeah, it's kind of like a black comedy thriller kind of film. You're right. And, actually, this may not surprise you, or may, I don't know, but actually, this is hard for me, but I also I'm leaning towards Carey Mulligan myself, mm-hmm. both for the win and for my pick personally, even though there are some phenomenal performances, And, I was thinking about Frances McDormand, too, in Nomadland, how she's, has this powerfully quiet understatement in performance. And I think there's an understatement, too, that Mulligan lends to it that is, indeed, that, as you put it, tethers the film down, especially with how far it goes, even when it goes into some territory that's problematic for on a script level. But I think Mulligan, definitely elevates the material and carries it through and through. And what I find so amazing about her performance in it is that she is also quiet, but there's this kind of like fierce, control, this fierce, determination she has, when she is trying to carry her plans through, or like when she has, either these guys that so-called nice guys that she then, basically humiliates. Or even like when she's carrying out her grand massive plan throughout the film, and you see the scenes, like, for example, I think of the one scene where there's like a counselor that she meets with, and then she she tells her like, oh, like, are you going to say sorry, or though I can tell you where your daughter is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. And that scene, like, her acting is just so incredible.
Yeah, I think she does. Well, she does something where, again, it's very, very tricky, and it's very, very hard for this kind of a role where you have somebody who is ostensibly an anti-hero, I guess, or nominally an anti-hero in the respect that they do things which might cause certain people in the audience to poo-poo. But I would say that she has this... I mean, the thing about her character is that her character has to fundamentally have, this sort of core of empathy. Because the whole thing is about her attempting to avenge this horrific thing that's happened to her very best friend. And at the same time, I think what makes Mulligan such a fascinating and such a deeply tragic figure in Promising Young Woman is the way that it shows how this person's empathy curdles into rage. And it's, again, not misplaced rage at all.
Oh, no, it's so, extremely justifiable rage.
But it's a kind of rage where she's even losing a sense of her own identity. You know, I mean, there's a wonderful moment where her parents, you know, they're both played by Clancy Brown and Jennifer Coolidge, which is something I never thought I'd see in a film, so I was happy to see that. But they both remind her that it's her birthday, and she's at first no idea what they're talking about. And then when she realizes it's her birthday, she just sort of says, oh, as in, like, as if they had told her that a friend of theirs had bought a new car or something.
Yeah, it's just like a, huh.
Yeah.
And then just like, then try to move on from it. I mean, yeah, it's like, and she's not, and she's a kind of antisocial, you know, doesn't interact. She doesn't seem to have like much of an identity apart from like, this is what she does for a living. Like apart from working in a coffee shop, she just spends her times like going to clubs, pretending to be drunk and be picked up by quote unquote nice guys just so she can like expose and humiliate them.
Right. Exactly. And I think that, but again, I think a role like this really requires a great degree of, I mean, if you want to get your audience to not necessarily sympathize, but certainly understand where this character is coming from, you have to have an actor who's able to inhabit a lot of these seemingly contradictory elements. And I mean, I think that Mulligan does a really great job at doing that.
Oh yeah. She does a wonderful job at balancing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think it'd be great if she won, but I mean, you know, I think it's like you, like we've said, it's a very competitive slate and, you know, we might even add a little addendum to this episode if we end up seeing the United States versus Billie Holiday or Pieces of Woman, and if Vanessa Kirby or Andrew Day end up knocking us out, then we'll have to stand corrected. Mm-hmm. But until that moment, here's a quick commercial break.
Well, welcome to the Oscars, or as it's known tonight, Cape Fear. Tonight, we are here to celebrate the movies, going to the movies. Hey, what are you doing tonight? Want to go to the movies? Hey, let's go to the movies. The movies, the only place in the world where you can get real imitation butter. Remember when there were movie palaces when you'd go to the movie theater and see one big movie? Now it's all multiplex and quadruplex. A quadruplex is you see one movie, but you hear four.
Welcome back from the break. We are going through our list of Oscar picks, and as we're making our way through who we think will win and who we think should win, I'm kind of thinking a little bit, Alex, about just sort of the slate of Best Director. And just kind of like what a... It's also a very interesting lineup because I know that, for example, last year there was a little bit of controversy about the lack of women directors. There was quite a big sort of outcry about Greta Gerwig being snubbed. I mean, truthfully, if you asked me, I think Celine Sciamma, you know, was a shoe-in for a nomination for Portrait of a Lady on Fire, though that film was completely absent. So, I mean, that was just a disappointment all around. But this year, at least it seems like that there's a broader swath, at least, you know, in terms of like along gender and even nationality, of filmmakers.
Yeah, there's including two women nominees, and mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have like Asian director, and we have a director from Denmark.
Mm-hmm. And yes, so of course we were talking about Chloe Zhao, who directed Nomadland, Thomas Vinterberg, who directed Another Round, David Fincher, and
Lee Isaac Chung
for Mank and Minari, respectively.
And Emerald Fennell for her directorial debut, Promising Young Woman.
Yeah, right, right. And this was, of course, Emerald Fennell's first. This is her directorial debut. And I mean, and so it's interesting you have like this mix of like, you know, these newcomers, you know, like Emerald Fennell, and then you have a filmmaker like David Fincher or Thomas Vinterberg who have been around since the early 90s, pretty much. And so you have this interesting dynamic that I'm kind of fascinated in terms of like the vanguard of filmmaking talent and then some of the newer kids on the block, so to speak. And I mean, it seems like that this year that the new kids on the block have got a lot going for them. I mean, even though it's not her first film, but Chloe Zhao seems primed to win the Oscar for Nomadland.
Yeah, it definitely seems like that. She's been winning all the precursor awards. And to be honest with you, I mean, actually, this is one of those categories that I feel is kind of, this is one of those categories which I feel was an easy call for me to make, even though I think there is a lot of skill and talent from these nominees. But I'm going with Chloe Zhao for Best Director.
Yeah, I am as well. I mean, it's one of those things where, I mean, I think that well, Nomadland was my favorite film of the bunch that's nominated here, and I think that it is a film that's so it's dependent upon how the material is executed, and I know that I think there's a lot you can kind of parse through when talking about Nomadland and whether or not it sort of operates as a wholly successful critique of, for example, kind of the way that the American economic structure has failed the most vulnerable citizens in this country. And all of Chloe Zhao's films, to some degree or another, are about people who live on the fringes of society. I mean, her first two films were mostly about Native American people living in South Dakota. And so this is kind of an interesting switch in terms of her actually having not only just have the protagonist be a white woman, but a movie star. And for me, that's what's interesting, is seeing that her working with Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, but then a whole cast of non-professional actors, many of them playing fictionalized versions of themselves, what you get is something that is like a throwback to the Italian neorealist tradition in terms of just fusing the everyday with kind of this appearance of people who you would consider actors or kind of stars, you know. And I'm thinking about like what Rossellini was doing with, you know, Ingrid Bergman in some of his films when they were partnering together. And I feel like that's a little bit of what Chloe Zhao is doing here. And I think what's remarkable about her accomplishment as a director is the way that she's, of course, the film is tightly scripted, but she weaves it in with, she weaves things together with something of a very almost, it has a very spontaneous sort of nature as well that gives this sense of forward momentum and reminds you that you're, of course, watching a road movie above all, but it's a road movie with twinges of the cosmic majesty of something like a Terrence Malick film. Certainly it's a less grim road movie than Malick's Badlands, and but it still, nevertheless, I think, also balances it really does, I think, a really strong job of balancing this aesthetic beauty, but one which does not aestheticize poverty or desperation.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because there was controversy over other aspects too, including like the whole angle of like the portrayal of like, you know, McDormand's character working at an Amazon warehouse, and it doesn't like maybe show necessarily like starkly as it could have, you know, like the conditions which Amazon's been attacked for how poorly they've treated their warehouse workers.
Mm-hmm.
But I also picked Chloe Zhao for Best Director because what I think she gets across so well as a director, you know, having seen all her movies, are, as you said, like, yeah, she has, because of the way she's able to create, you know, she has a story structure, but she's able to allow some spontaneity, a little bit of improvisation. And it's like she transports her audiences into these sort of like pockets of rural Americana. And it's like we're witnessing these people just engaging with each other, or like, it's almost like, as corny as it sounds, but it's almost like even we're almost forgetting their characters, but like we think of them as almost real people. And I think what she does so well is that it never feels jarring. Like when you see Frances McDormand or David Strathairn interact with non-professional actors, they never stick out like a sore thumb. They actually almost blend in perfectly, you know, with the rest of the cast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a testament to Zhao's strengths as a director. And I think it's interesting how she's made her mark on American indie cinema, even though she's now branching out to Hollywood. I mean, not just having movie stars to work with, but now her next film will be a Marvel film, which is very curious.
Yeah, that's very curious indeed. And I'm not quite sure still how to feel about Immortals existing, but we'll see when it comes out, I guess.
We'll see. But, you know, with this, I think that it's interesting to see, you know, a filmmaker who is inspired by Rossellini, but also, honestly, like, I look at the works of Terry Malick, like, not just Badlands, but Days of Heaven, and also, mm-hmm. like, you know, Haskell Wexler, like, with his film Medium Cool, like those kinds of movies where sometimes it's like almost like these improvisational, almost, you know, interview-esque kinds of dialogue scenes with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
But but she makes it flow. It never feels like it lags on for too long or anything. And no, I think it's a beautifully done movie.
Yeah. And I think that And that does actually tie in really well with who we think might, should, or will win Best Picture. Because I know that we've talked a lot about Nomadland, but I mean, there are several other movies that are nominated, and some of them we've already talked about, like Sound of Metal, Mank, The Father, mm-hmm. Minari,
Promising Young Woman.
Promising Young Woman. What else? Ma Rainey's Black Bottom?
No. Say Judas and the Black Messiah?
Judas and the Black Messiah. Ah, yes, of course. Of course. Trial of Chicago 7.
Yes.
I think looking back at this roster, I think it kind of, before we even say who we think should win, I think just looking at this collection of Best Picture nominees, it once again gives this impression that we were kind of talking a little bit about earlier. Like, what does the year 2020, how is that reflected in this collection of movies? And I think that these Best Picture films all kind of are attempting to speak to an American... to some sort of to films that are trying to sort of engage and deconstruct popular American cultural narratives. Even something like Mank, of course, it's about the Hollywood film industry, but it's also very much about Hollywood's own complicity in terms of propagating media, which serves to consolidate power amongst a hegemony or a ruling class. And I think that, you know, it's really interesting just thinking about how all these films are in some way sort of posing a question about what kind of an America do we want to live in. And I think the film that kind of gives maybe the clearest answer in the present tense is Nomadland. I mean, it's maybe just saying that it might be an America that could be one that's, that allows some sort of form of liberation outside of the strict confines of a capitalist structure where people are interacting with each other on this sort of consumer producer basis. Not to say that, I mean, I'm kind of speaking a little bit in leftist or even Marxist terms, and I wouldn't even call the film a Marxist film in any sense. And if you were talking about Alex earlier, that the film had been criticized for maybe some insufficient criticism of Amazon working conditions, which I think is completely a fair thing to put out there. But I do think that Nomadland, it's my favorite of the Best Picture nominees precisely because it has a really interesting, it toes this really fine line again of just sort of really diving deep into something that is so intrinsic within the American character, which is this sense of exploration. You know, I mean, it's completely inextricable from something like Manifest Destiny. And it's been, you know, expounded and perpetuated by, you know, those mythic tales with people like Lewis and Clark, and then you would see fiction writers like Jack Kerouac writing about, you know, like On the Road. And I think Nomadland occupies that rich, almost sort of literary tradition of being a road movie that's sort of about the land and about our relationship with America in sort of this cosmic sense. And I think Zhao, like, manages to capture, and the film, I think, expresses that sort of dynamic, but in a way that's not didactic. And it's not attempting to proselytize in a way that something like, I feel, The Trial of the Chicago 7 does. I mean, if only because I think Aaron Sorkin is just a far more didactic filmmaker in every respect.
He is more didactic. And I think, consequently, he comes across in his writing, he's a very talented and gifted writer, but, you know, he comes across as a bit lecturing and even maybe a little patronizing too, I feel, to his viewers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what keeps me at distance, arm's distance with him. But yeah, and what I also like about Nomadland is for, yeah, you know, all the reasons you said, and also because there's something kind of beautiful about this movie coming out now at this time when so many people have had to, you know, stay at home, quarantine them from loved ones and just environments, just, it's like blocking off almost everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's so easy to forget about, especially as vaccinations are coming around here in the United States, like, and this question of, like, what are we going to do now? What comes next for us? Mm-hmm. And it's easy to get caught up in, like, you know, the troubles of what's going on with the country, is, you know, especially all the civil unrest that's happening. But then you also look at, like, with the landscape that is portrayed in Nomadland, it's like to open up and you realize, oh yes, this is also a part of who we are. And there's something kind of, it's so closely tied to this country's identity and also to our identity as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes it kind of, to make people, I think, more in tune with their surroundings, with nature, I think it's a beautiful thing. But also, like, because with history, of course, that means people that, you know, pass on and letting go. And that is a key, also a core component of this film. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's even that beautiful speech near the end where the guy talks about, you know, the saying, see you down the road.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that was Jim Clark, I want to say.
Yes, I believe it was.
Yeah. I know, it's a film very much about grief as well, because of Frances McDormand's character and... she's still mourning her husband passing, and I think that's another reason why the film has resonated so much, because I think, you know, I mean, this has been a tremendous year of loss for so many Americans, for so many people all over the world, and it's an ongoing tragedy, and you know, you have a film that's sort of putting out this question of grief and about how to process it and how to move on and how to live with yourself and be comfortable with yourself, but at the same time not become alienated from other people. And I think that's sort of course, like, that challenge, you know, is, I think it does poignantly speak to our present moment. And it's something that I don't think Nomadland gives us an exact answer, nor should it really give us an exact answer, because, I mean, that, you know, it's not prescriptive in that way to, you know, everybody. I mean, I think Zhao is much more interested in how individual Americans overcome their pain and their feeling of isolation from whatever kind of dominant social order they're living just on the fringes of. And she's, I think she's offering a sense of optimism because they continue to keep going. I mean, again, it ties into this quote about James Baldwin's that I really love coming back to now and again, where he keeps saying, you know, I consider myself an optimist because I'm alive. You know, I guess I don't have really any, I'm paraphrasing really, but he's just saying that he has no other alternative, you know, to be anything but an optimist because he is alive. And I feel like, you know, several movies like Nomadland sort of, you know, they take that sort of core sentiment and transpose it into something that's, I'd say, is stirring. And I'm really glad that it's doing so well, and I hope that it wins, but I don't know. We'll just have to see how things wrap up with the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe Trial of the Chicago 7 could win this, or another film, you know, Minari, you know. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But
which is also, I mean, Minari is also interesting. We haven't really spoken about that film as well, but it is also very much about, like, an engagement of how we consider ourselves Americans versus, you know, but then also with how that kind of gets tied up into a sense of cultural identification and this sort of connection to a homeland that you haven't gone back to and you can't quite really go back to, but then you sort of bring a little bit of that into your new home. You know, I mean, speaking as to the immigrant experience, of course.
Yeah, and even though it may not be the immigrant experience, but certainly that sense of, like, you know, with cultural trauma, and, like, I also think about Judas and the Black Messiah and how that, you know, deals with some of these issues too in its own way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And particularly in a sense of, like, I mean, what's so interesting about Judas and the Black Messiah is that it also has a sense that it's a character study of two actors, neither of whom are nominated for lead. For some inexplicable reason.
Yeah, I have no reason why. I mean, that's more ridiculous than when they nominated Al Pacino for Best Supporting Actor for Godfather Part 1.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it is more ridiculous because the film is about these two characters. And, it's just one of the few grievances which I think we are going to air about the Oscars, because... I always have my grievances about the Oscars every year, and, you know, this year was no exception. And you know, we could go on and on and on and say, like, oh, they should have nominated this, should have nominated that. But is there, like, a particular performance or a movie or script or anything that you felt, Alex, was kind of given the shaft?
Well, that's kind of, it's difficult for me to list one specifically.
Like I said, we can go on and on and on.
Yeah, I mean, they're just. So many titles, like, you're right, there are so many excellent films that got completely overlooked, and it was a real shame. And there are some notable titles which I could mention about that I know, like, were even mentioned in your top 10 list, like First Cow and Never Rarely Sometimes Always, or even got special mention, like The Assistant or I'm Thinking of Ending Things, the Charlie Kaufman film. Mm-hmm. But there's actually one film I wanted to see which I think slipped under a lot of people's radar when it came out. You know, it's just mainly screened through, like, film festivals. And I know it's had a little bit of a run in L.A., but I don't think a lot of people have heard about this movie. And it's actually, I saw it last year, one full year ago, at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. And it's called Just Don't Think I'll Scream, which it sounds like a horror film, but I guess it is kind of a horror film in some ways, but it's also kind of it's more like a interesting character retrospective, a study piece, if you will. And it was a documentary / film essay written and directed by Frank Bouvet, who, you know, he kind of makes it a very personal kind of experience where he talks about during this period when in April to October of 2016, you know, he's a gay man who had just broken up with his boyfriend. And so he moved to this small little village where he kind of like, it's a very kind of like reserved kind of village. People don't interact with each other a lot. And so he kind of closed himself off from the rest of the village and to stay inside his home, basically watching movies. And it says at the beginning how he apparently between April and October of 2016, he had watched over 400 films. And this movie shows clips and samples from all those films while he's talking. And he's talking about various experiences, like he's talking about his upbringing, his life, his views on politics, his concerns with the status of the world, and also about like his kind of almost addictive attitude towards consuming all these movies and of all different kinds of genres or films. It didn't care what, whether German movies or pink films. I noticed a clip from Elf at one point. I mean, it's all these kinds. And so I just think like, I feel there's certainly a potency and relevance to it in regards to how I'm sure many people, especially if you're film lovers like us, during the pandemic have spent our times watching movies. And it certainly can be rewarding. I feel it's a rewarding experience to watch something that you haven't seen before, you know, and to gain an insight, something new. But it's easy to kind of fall down the rabbit hole of like doing nothing but consuming and consuming stuff until even like the direct Bouvet says, he doesn't feel like he's looking through a window, but he's looking through a mirror. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, I found it like, it's one of those films that was like so riveting for me and it was unforgettable, even though it seems so simple with just the collection of clips and imagery from all these movies and just his voice talking. But with the stories he gives, like even when he talks about things like his father and his strained relationship with them, and actually a moment when they were watching a film together, The Sky's Yours, and then during this point his father like suffered like a heart attack or so, and that just kind of like filled him with guilt and shock and anger, and he kept asking himself the question during the time, like, why did it have to happen now? Why during this movie? And so and there's also another point too where he becomes so kind of tired of like being caught in this rut, he realizes of course he eventually has to make a change. Even like when a person asks, hey, do you want to watch a film? And it shows like a clip of a character gouging his eyes out. So it's like to have the films also be a way to externalize one's feelings, but also to think about like both of them maybe in an impressionistic way and also literal sense. It was one of the most powerful and unforgettable movies I had seen of last year.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way you're describing all this right now, I mean, it certainly strikes a chord in the context of this last year in terms of people being confined to their homes and thinking to themselves. I mean, whether you're a cinephile or you're someone who got on the Tiger King train, you know, I mean, people were consuming content like crazy. I mean, I know I was. I was just watching so many movies in the first month or so of lockdown in England, and I was just thinking to myself at first, oh, this is fine, I can just watch a movie a day, I'll just watch, you know, some Bud Bedeker Western someday, and then I'll watch maybe some Henri Georges Clouseau films the other day. I mean, and it felt all right, and then after a while, there is this kind of toxic relationship you have if you don't administer self-care. You begin to develop this sort of this real disdain for, or you're under threat of developing a disdain for the very thing which once provided you a bit of respite or comfort. And I think that that's, so that dangerous transition in terms of your relationship with an art form is something that I'm very confident a lot of people in the world have experienced.
Yeah, it may not have been the most technically complex of documentaries, you know, and I imagine like not everyone would have loved this film or respond to it like I have, but I feel like, you know, with the I think the emotional connection it just makes, I feel it's undeniable for me anyways, and I think it would have been quite something if it got at least a Best Documentary nomination. That would have been something.
Well, it's a film that I definitely still need to check out. I unfortunately missed it last year. I saw a bunch, but that wasn't one of them. But it definitely sounds like a film I should really seek out.
Yeah, it's like, and it may not be quite as like ambitious in scope as, say, like a City Hall or something. It's more, you know, intimate and psychological because it's focusing on this one guy. But still.
Well, I mean, but that's like, say, you know, Frederick Wiseman is the kind of filmmaker who will paint an entire canvas populated with all of these interlocking branches of institutions in society. I mean, I can't see anybody putting a gun to his head and saying, all right, Frederick Wiseman, you've got to make a film about one person, you know?
Yeah, this movie is more like, instead of it being a canvas about a community, it's more like if somebody was doing a portrait, self-portrait, but like they were just inserting all these tiny little images of all these movies to, you know, make up the face.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I should check it out. I really, you know, I had a lot of trouble thinking about, like you, Alex, what I would kind of highlight for a sort of a film that I felt kind of got the shaft. Because I think there are a lot of really strong films that were completely omitted this year at the Oscars. And I think that, you know, I had some difficulty sort of racking my brain about, like, one thing that I'd want to pick. And I think you kind of actually brought it up earlier when you were kind of listing some names of movies, and I thought I just might as well kind of bring it up. But I think one of the films that sort of lingered with me when I watched it twice actually, and I liked it even more the second time I watched it, and it's a film that I felt like I could have maybe have broken through, and it ultimately didn't, was Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things. And it's a film that I do think in several years from now, when I think a lot of critics are looking back on Charlie Kaufman's career, I think that I'm Thinking of Ending Things will be regarded as not just simply a curio, but one of his key works, because it's something that fuses a lot of his longstanding obsessions about neuroses and memory and aging and death and decay and insecurity, and it channels all of that, but it's one of the most audacious scripts that he's ever written, in the fact that he's adapting it from another person's work, and fairly closely, much more closely than he did with Susan Orlean's book, The Orchid Thief, when he was doing adaptation. But he's turning it in, but he's really diving even deeper into the way that popular culture has dictated the ways we perceive the world and the ways we present ourselves to each other and transform our sort of perceptions and the projections that we latch onto other people, real or imagined. And I think that it's something that it seems almost scattershot in terms of a script that puts together references to things from Pauline Kael to John Nash to Oklahoma, but none of it feels accidental or incidental. Far from it. It's an incredibly precise and finely calibrated script that also manages to mount a great deal of tension as it continues going on. And I mean, some of it's very uncomfortable in terms of just an early car ride that makes it seems like the complete opposite of, for example, like a car trip you would see two characters in an Abbas Kiarostami movie taking. Instead of like this lush, kind of earthy ground, it's just cold, frigid winter in the middle of like Oklahoma. But I mean, when Kaufman kind of delves into a little more Lynchian territory with this script, then there's the way that he decompresses and manipulates and fluctuates time and space is very playful, but it's all it's all understandable in terms of where he's coming from and what he's attempting to accomplish. And I think it's also aided tremendously by a really accomplished and exceptional cast. I mean, I think both, if we're talking about the two Jessies, Jesse Buckley and Jesse Plemons, I mean, they both gave really, I think, remarkable performances in this film. And I think they're both very challenging performances because they're challenging characters to inhabit, particularly as the film goes on and we feel like we learn a little more about who each of these people in this relationship are. And they're aided and abetted by some wonderful supporting players like Toni Collette and David Thewlis, who are absolutely hilarious in a mordantly dark, almost eraser-head way at this nightmarish dinner. It's a film that I think it really, it's not a film I'm terribly surprised wasn't successful when it came to the awards season, but it is a film that I was somewhat hoping, among several others, might actually get at least maybe a screenplay nomination. And at the very least, I think it's a film that's more than worth a look if you haven't seen it.
I completely agree with you. Actually, I'm Thinking of Ending Things was one of my favorite films, too, of the year. And I feel like, you know, because Charlie Kaufman, of course, had been lauded as a writer, you know, when he, like, even when he came to the film scene with, like, being John Malkovich. But I think just looking at his trilogy of films he's done as a director, this, Synecdoche, New York, and Anomalisa, I think he actually, I think years from now, if not already, I think he's going to be, I think he'll be widely regarded as like a very accomplished director, you know, and certainly one of the most audacious American independent directors to have come around.
Oh, absolutely. Unquestionably.
And yeah, because of like the ambition he puts in, like what he's trying to talk about with the films, the vast array of themes, but I know they can be heady and challenging for viewers, but I think if you're willing to go with them, they're so emotionally resonant, so emotional and challenging. And I just don't see a lot of filmmakers making movies the way he does. And it was also quite fascinating for me to think of how Netflix had funded this film, especially when they, you know, when one of the popular cultural icons that you just referenced was A Beautiful Mind, and how it was around the same time they released a Ron Howard film, Hillbilly Elegy.
And I mean, I think, and, you know, and one of the things that I love also about the script, you know, among other things as well, is it's about the way that, you know, mental illness is also sort of portrayed in cinema. And kind of this sort of vision of, like, when we present someone as a savant. And of course, and I think Charlie Kaufman, like, kind of eviscerates that in his script pretty viciously. But at the same time, I think I do agree, I think that he recognizes a lot of himself in the characters who do latch onto those images, who do sort of buy into these sorts of, these manufactured images of success that constitute what would make someone a nice person. And it's also a movie about a nice guy who realizes that he is maybe in fact not a nice guy, you know, that he's as guilty of controlling possessive, toxic, masculine practices as much as the things that he's claiming to decry. And I think that, you know, it's interesting to see how that sort of is of a piece with a movie also like Promising Young Woman, which is, of course, a very, very different movie. But they're all sort of speaking to this current landscape as well in terms of gender politics and about how we kind of think about, you know, our relationship to men and women when we create art and how we sort of do justice to particularly the experience of someone whose experience is not our own.
Yeah, I feel like Charlie Kaufman is the only filmmaker I can think of, aside from Don Hertzfeldt, who I think can really talk, who does well, like talking about like mental illness and anxiety and mortality, while also trying to looking at like maybe thinking about the grander scheme of things, of the cosmos and life.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we could, like I said, we could talk about all of our grievances with the Oscars. And I could have just filled this whole episode talking up, you know, about First Cow, which is, if you haven't seen First Cow, please do yourself a favor and watch it. It's
wonderful film.
Just a delightful, wonderful little movie. And you know, it doesn't matter if Kelly Reichardt gets an Oscar nomination or not. She's Kelly Reichardt. She's, you know.
Exactly.
But I will say that I am keen to see how the award ceremony pans out and you know, who ends up winning and, you know, and then whoever wins, you know, I mean, I think it's, again, as is often the case, you know, it doesn't really matter because the best films will survive and endure, that have been nominated this year at the Oscars, and the others will just become little footnotes in history. And as Walter Cronkite once said, that's the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. It will be interesting to see how it plays out, especially because they're trying to, you know, they've been kind of a little iffy. They said they didn't want to, like, Zoom things, but then a Zoom kind of, like, calls with acceptance speeches. But they also are, like, having the ceremony located at various different places, like whether it's the Kodak Theater or Union Station, or even they have what they call hubs located in London and in Paris.
Well, I just hope that Tony Hopkins, if he does win, that he gets to Zoom from his house with that delightful cat that he plays piano for.
Maybe his cat will accept on his behalf.
Oh, there you go. There we go. I think, you know, it's high time we had a cat accept an Oscar.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, what about Mike Myers for Cat in the Hat?
Way to end the program on a bad note, Alex. Oh, man, now we're just going to get fan mail about Cat in the Hat. But, you know, all that aside, thanks again to everyone out there for listening and following along with us on this very strange and peculiar moment in film history that we're all living through right now. And yeah, we'd love to hear about what some of your thoughts are about the Oscar nominees, about what you think should win, what will win, or if there was anything that you felt was particularly snubbed that we haven't brought up yet. If there's a particular film that you think people should be keeping their eye out for to just really track down, we'd love to hear it.
And if you have, like, maybe a favorite film that has won an Oscar in a category like Best Picture or something else, then please let us know.
Or, you know, like a technical category. I can imagine someone's like, oh, yeah, The Grinch is my favorite movie to ever win the Best Makeup Oscar. And
Well, it's no An American Werewolf in London.
No.
But with that in mind, now that we've run the gamut of, like, live-action Dr. Seuss movies.
All two
of them. That wasn't so hard, was it?
No.
And with that being said, thank you all once again. As always, be well, stay safe, and regardless of the Oscars, continue watching great movies.
Thank you, and remember, we're all in this together.
Going outside, get myself a bride, get me a woman to call.